And welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you discussions about history and film and history. And this is a special series. This is now our second episode, which covers the third part of the show Masters of the Air, available on Apple TV, about the 8th Bomber Group. Am I saying that right, Luke? 8th Bomber Company? What am I? 8th Air Force? What? 8th? I like the number 8. It's my lucky number. Nobody's here for me.
It's the 8th Air Force, but within the 8th Air Force, there's the 8th Bomber Command, which is the bombers. The 8th Fighter Command is the fighters. So you have a Bomber Command and a Fighter Command that are all underneath the 8th Air Force. But what we're talking about is the 8th Air Force.
Right. All right. Well, good. Well, the people talking with us today, as you just heard, Dr. Luke Truxell and Dr. Sarah Myers, two of my great friends and specialists in the air campaign of World War II. So the way we're going to roll this episode today is, again, we're going to do some brief recaps, some spoiler-free recaps. So if you're coming to this and want to know what we're going into in this episode, by all means. And then we'll kind of open this up and talk about the episode as we saw it and what's to come. So, all right, Luke, Sarah, holy shit.
Happy to be back.
Yeah.
This was intense, this episode.
Yes. I told you in the group chat with Sarah, as I was like, I was really just trying not to text you because I was like, have you seen it yet? Because I knew exactly what you were waiting for because you had mentioned in the previous episode about, I think one of your favorite actors is Barry Keoghan, I think.
Yep, definitely. And he is a star in this show, and we are not revealing anything that happens to him just yet in this episode.
Nope.
Or anyone else in the World War II of the world. So people who are listening in should know that the three of us have a group text going on right now as we're kind of plotting out what we're going to do before the episode and things like that. And then there's a separate text between Luke and Sarah because they want to talk about the episode as they're seeing it. And I want to remain dumb. I don't know what's going on ahead of time. I'm wanting to try to watch this episode alongside everybody else who's listening into this podcast right now who don't know really World War II, so we can kind of have these organic conversations. But that also means that Luke is now chomping at the bit to reveal the stacks of books and information he has compiled for this episode. I don't know what he's got in store for us today, but I know it is a lot. So it is are you going to drop the bomb on us? Sorry. God, I'm dad jokes. I'm so sorry. All right, Sarah, what'd you think of this episode?
So the literal phrase that I sent to Luke was, I feel a little bit like they lost the forest for the trees, or if that's how the phrase goes. I always say that phrase. Yeah, okay. Because I wanted to see them pull back a little bit to give us a big, I feel like you can do both in an episode, have something be really close, right? Look at one experience, one battle, one unit, whatever, but then pull back for a second and give us a bigger picture and then go back in. And I wanted them to do that. And Luke had told me that he felt like the same. So Luke, you want to jump in? You're really welcome to.
We were texting about this and we had the same reaction I texted Sarah because I was a bit worried that me being a person who's read a lot about this mission, that maybe I, had just gotten too invested in this mission that I somehow felt like I was missing something. And so I had to text Sarah. I was like, I feel like I'm missing something. And basically what I wrote down, because I knew that this conversation would come up based on our text, was I felt disappointed in the episode in this way. It's a very good episode. But the way I described it to Sarah, it's like the student that turns in B+ work when you know they have A+ potential. The episode does have A+ potential, but if a few scenes are rewritten, a few scenes are done just a little bit better, I think you have a incredible episode there. But it got so down into the mission that we just never got the context. We never got the big picture very well. And that's just missing throughout this entire episode is the bigger picture. And they got too zoned in on the bomb group and they got too zoned in on this one particular raid, but not even just this particular raid. They zoomed in even further than that to this bomb group in this raid. And I think what would have helped is widening the picture a little bit at some point in the episode to a scene with, maybe 8th Bomber Command or, 8th Air Force Headquarters, just do a little bit of a widespread shot a little bit to kind of take this whole thing in from a larger picture, because we just got too zoned in. What they did very well. Right before I walked up here, one of the things that hit me is this was an episode about choices that you make in combat. And there's lots of scenes where choices have to be made that involve life or death decisions. And, I'm not going to go into spoilers, but that was my big takeaway. Is it was a very good episode, B+, but it's just missing that extra thing to just have that real impact that the Pacific and Band of Brothers had.
I love the theme of choices. That was great.
Thanks.
Yeah, I actually wrote down the fog of war because of the fog of war in this episode, but we're going to get into that. This is good because I was hoping we could really not just fanboy over this series and really have these critical engagements with this. Because I was telling Sarah before we started recording, she's like, "What do you think?" I'm like, "Me lucky, me planes go splody." and I was like, "The action of this was great." And you guys had told me the week, they even pulled back. They could have even gone even further. Oh, yeah. So this is really cool to hear you guys' response to this. Let's do this. Before we dive into a spoiler-filled recap of this episode, you're talking about the bigger picture here. What specifically are we talking about? This is kind of set over a single mission, a sortie. Is that correct? What are we looking at in this particular episode?
Sorry, I have to change out notepads because this is a big raid. Basically, this is a double strike mission. And one of the things that gets missed in the big picture is that the purpose of the raid is, yes, you want to hit the Regensburg aircraft facilities, but what you're really after is the ball bearings at Schweinfurt. And not to get into too much, but they don't really explain why. And that was something that I texted Sarah. I was like, so what's the whole purpose of, you know, they mentioned in like one line about it, show a ball bearing, and you're like, why does this matter? Why, you know, and that's kind of like, you know, if a student's writing an essay, I would be like, so what, you know, question mark in the thing. And so, but this is the beginning of the really dark days of the 8th Air Force. And so when we look at this raid, it's a disaster. 60 B-17s are shot down. Also, this comes almost 2 weeks after the 54 B-24s are shot down at Ploesti. And in fact, the situation's so bad that Arnold does a trip to the 8th Air Force from Washington, D.C. He's already had one heart attack in the war at this point. And he comes in. He's the head of the Army Air Forces. He comes in, and immediately upon arrival on September 2nd, he inspects things, sends off a message on September 3rd saying, I need 217 B-17s here now. Divert them from wherever they're going. I want them for the 8th Air Force. Also, divert the long-range escort fighters. I want them all here now. I want P-51s, P-38s. Next, we need a new Air Force in the Med, which will become the 15th. And finally, we need to start reorganizing. So this raid coupled with the Ploesti raid really was a shot of cold water on the brass at the top. Ira Aker was shocked by the raid. Hap Arnold, nobody thought that this went well. Now, that's not what they tell the public. That's not how they sell it. But if you look at how they react, not good. And in fact, they actually have to pause bombing operations deep into Germany for about a month. Okay. So that's the bigger picture, I think.
Yeah, Luke actually sent me, everybody can Google this. There's a propaganda video that the National World War II Museum has posted. It's an official one from World War II that the National World War II Museum has posted of the 1 minute message to the public about all of this. And basically the message comes in April 1944, and they talk about the heavy casualties and how like bad it is. And then they say, I forget the exact phrasing, but as of April of 1944, everything's better now, you know? So they're trying to like very much like gloss over everything. And I mean, yeah.
Propaganda. One of the ways in which the Americans kind of hid bad defeats. You can't hide the losses that much the American public will know about, but the way they kind of cover it up, but they kind of, I guess you could say, put a spoonful of sugar on the medicine to help it go down, is they talk about the pilots, and they'll talk about daring raid comes up. You know, right. At Ploesti, they hand out a lot of medals of honor. So they talk about the bravery and the skill of the pilots to kind of gloss over the fact that this was bad. you know? And so it's a way to kind of try to like make it look not as bad as it was.
All right. Well, let's jump in now. So if you're listening in, now that we've kind of gotten into where this episode is taking place, the mission at stake, we're going to go ahead and start spoiling this episode. So if you haven't listened or seen the episode yet, you can go ahead and pause this. If not, just go ahead and listen in. And let's talk about what we saw here. I've got a few different questions here regarding some phrases and things like that. And the very first thing I saw was the phrase max effort, which I'd always seen when Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool talks about going and killing bad guys on the Sarah's like, you dork. But what is maximum effort in terms of Air Force bombing campaigns? What does this mean? I think I know.
Do you want to take this one, Sarah, or do you want me?
I was like, I don't know, like, numbers. If do you, Luke?
It's not a numbers thing. It's everybody that can physically fly flies no matter their mental state. If you can get in a B-17,
wow. Well, I'm remembering something different. Okay,
operate
you go.
Machinery, you go. They explain it better in the film 12 O'Clock High because they actually asked this question. The flight surgeon asked it, and he basically says, you know, what is a maximum effort mission? The first bomb group commander says, I don't know. The second guy says, basically anybody that can fly flies no matter their mental state. And again, this is a conversation I had with a flight surgeon before he passed away at a reunion. And he basically said he tried to end this policy unsuccessfully. But the reason why is, and I'd heard other veterans talk about, is you get a pilot up there that is not doing good, that is not mentally fit to fly, bad things happen. And in this one case, a collision happened during forming up. And I actually got to interview the tail gunner who watched it happen. He was in the tail position, saw it happen as they were forming up over England. He said he couldn't explain what happened, but the plane basically just veered into the other plane. And the pilot that was put on a max effort mission, despite the flight surgeon desperately protesting not to put him on the mission. But they still had to put him on because it was max effort. So max effort, if you can physically operate the machinery, no matter your mental state, no matter where you're at, you're going.
Wow.
And yeah, there's historians that study the impact of what Luke is saying, with the impact of trauma, not just long-term, but also of pilots' like mental health and well-being, and how you make mistakes like that when you aren't. I mean, they don't have the words for it at the time because they don't have diagnoses then. But when you have things like moral injury or post-traumatic stress, and yeah, you can go, Luke.
Oh, and I would say that Sarah's right on the PTSD. They made flak houses to try to get people to, like, they would go to these places to relax, recuperate. But also, one of the things that doesn't technically count as a wound that makes you technically physical to fly is, like, there are physical injuries that basically make you, yeah, you're good to go. Blisters. You know, that was something I didn't even think about until I interviewed a veteran who mentioned both of his pilots at one point had blisters so bad because of damaged B-17 that they crash landed, and because of the nature of the damage, that their hands, when they came out of the plane, they had to be put on, basically grounded, because their hands were so bloody from the blisters. But if you have blisters, if your hands are not really in good shape, if your body is not in peak physical condition, you're still flying. So again, this could be mental, it could also be physical.
Yeah, this is a thing that, you know, I was talking to Sarah about a little bit earlier, and I know that she talks about in her work is the physical. This is not like cruise control, like getting up in a 737 and flying to Atlanta. You are fighting this aircraft in a lot of ways, right? I mean, these guys, and they show this in these planes, these guys are really having to muscle these aircraft. Am I correct?
Yeah, General Arnold literally told, like, the women Air Force service pilots at one of their graduation ceremonies that he said his phrase was that, I didn't know if a slip of a young girl could handle the controls of a B-17, because he's referencing the fact that it takes so much mental strength. And like you said, you're basically like fighting against it in certain circumstances, right? Or depending on, you know, weather, et cetera. And so, yes, you're very much not like using any sort of automated system where you don't need to use your muscles.
That's interesting, Sarah, because I think, and I think I saw a document somewhere, I don't know if I got a picture of it, but I think I saw a document somewhere you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this also relates to Black Fighter pilots as well, is that one of the criticisms that Arnold laid on Black Fighter pilots was physical endurance and physical capabilities and strength to basically fly these aircraft. And one of the ways in which some of the people who did not want the Tuskegee program to succeed and the 99th Fighter Squadron to succeed, they didn't send enough replacement pilots to rotate in and out. And so they would have problems with that. So again, this is, like I said, this is something that, you know, there's a physical side and a mental side to this. So it's interesting about the Arnold thing. That seems to keep coming up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And makes you're right think. On the Tuskegee Airmen too. Yeah.
All right, we see early on, who is the guy? Is this the colonel that's talking about, that's giving the talk about the ball bearings, the guy with the great mustache? I don't have his name directly in front of me, but he always reminds me the way he's kind of talking. He's like, yeah, see, I'm the 1940s guy. But he's talking about, okay, we're going to bomb ball bearing factories. I know in our previous discussions, Luke and Sarah, we've talked about the importance of ball bearings. In order not to give this episode a B+, can you explain the importance of ball bearings to the German war effort? Luke.
Okay.
It's all you.
Yeah. These are basically anti-friction bearings, and I'm not an engineer, so again, this is where I would rely more on an engineer to explain it. But basically, they help with kind of making these machines work, and they help with kind of keeping, again, it depends on the nature of the ball bearings. There's anti-friction. There's also ball bearings but basically they're parts in basically every machine that you need to operate. So like, you know, tanks, mechanized vehicles, aircraft, they're just in about every vehicle that you would use. I've even seen stuff like ads for them. They're around today. I've seen ads for them like in skateboards. So they help with like, you know, wheels moving. And again, an engineer could probably explain the elements of a ball bearing better than I could, but they're just in about every vehicle that you would use to wage war. Now, it's not just that this is a vital part in all these big, you know, vehicles, planes, aircraft, tanks and stuff, but also it's the way the ball bearings have been dispersed or lack of dispersed. There's all kinds of other German systems that you could target that would also have the same kind of effect, like oil, or like oil would be the biggest one I would think of. But why go after ball bearings instead of oil at this point? Well, 57% of the ball bearings are produced at one location in Germany, Schweinfurt. So you knock out 57% of ball bearings in a successful raid. The production is not dispersed like all the other German industry at this time. And you can cause a lot of problems for, shall we say, German war production in producing aircraft, tanks, bombers, and all the stuff you need for the heavy weapons of war. But there's one thing that the Allies don't really understand that they're going to find out, not after this raid, but after the October one, because they're going to go back. But what they're going to find out later on is that you can offset production loss by buying from someone else, like Sweden, which is what the Germans do. And so that's kind of one of the things, is there's a misunderstanding that yes, 57% is produced here, but there are ways to offset production damage. Also, you hit a target, the Germans are going to repair it. That's assuming you actually destroy what you hit, and that's also assuming you actually hit the target, which they don't.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, Sarah, maybe we can dive into this. We all know that Germans run on sauerkraut. Were there ever attacks on cabbage fields by these bombing campaigns?
I'm shaking my head because I have no idea.
I'm like, you know, considering the way that the war developed, I would like to say no. And I'm 99% no. But when you consider how much they bombed, the nature of the bombing and the bombing tactics that they constantly tried and evolved and moved around, you know, I'm thinking it's probably no, but we have seen attacks against food used as a way of waging war. The answer is no. I've never seen anything in the records like that. But it wouldn't surprise me if there is a mission somewhere in the vast missions that were conducted, that there was some kind of attack on food.
You brought up the thing about buying ball bearings from Sweden. Sweden is neutral in the war. What is going on with Sweden? And are they neutral? Are they allied with Germany? This is the very first time I've ever really considered Sweden in terms of the war.
You can go, Luke, if you want to.
Well, because of that, does that open them up to Allied bombing raids if they are supplying Germany?
Well, they are neutral, but the nice thing about being neutral is that you can kind of play with both sides. And okay. So, yes, they're going to sell to Germany, but they're kind of caught in a really awkward position because they have, you know, German-occupied Finland to their west. They have Germany to their south, and they have the Soviet Union to their east. And they're kind of, due to the necessity of their kind of diplomatic and strategic situation, and the interest of both Germany and the Soviet Union long term, they're having to kind of be very careful with what they do. So selling to Germany makes sense from a diplomatic angle. It makes you money, but also it keeps the Germans happy. You got to remember, Hitler is very aggressive diplomatically, and he's already invaded one Scandinavian country. You have Stalin, who is also, sorry, it wasn't Finland, it's Norway to the west, sorry. Yes. He'd already invaded Norway, but Germany's ally Finland is to the east. Again, you're surrounded by a German ally and a German-occupied state, and you got the Soviets to your east as well. So again, you're in a very tight diplomatic situation, and I think if you're Sweden, you're trying not to do anything that would give Germany the reason to think, oh, we'll just go get those ball bearings ourselves by invading. So again, just to correct myself, Norway's to the west, which is occupied by Germany, and Finland's to the east. And again, Finland is a German ally.
Well, to be fair, I'm an Americanist, so I don't really know what Europe looks like. So that's okay. I have a question for you. I want to get into this bombing because when they introduced the idea of the bombs, it's like, okay, we're going to do this and there's going to be these three parts and we're all going to join up and then there's going to be this feint maneuver and then the fighters are going to think that we're all done. They're all going to resupply and then that's when the real bombs are going to come. And I'm like, oh, this mission sounds awesome. We should do this mission. Why does this mission go to hell? What's there's a wait because of cloud cover, and then it feels like the brass just decides, oh hell, just send them up and we'll figure it out once we get up there. Is that what goes on here?
Sarah, do you want to handle big picture? Or do you want so and then I get jump into the
I was thinking you're smaller, okay, you can go. To, I'll just keep jumping in.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, you can go.
Okay. This is one of my criticisms of kind of the episode is they don't really adequately explain all the events that kind of cascaded to create this moment. First, we got to start off with the fact that this raid had been planned quite a while ago. This raid is being championed, like the Ploesti raid, by Hap Arnold, who is very hard on his Air Force commanders and is unrelenting in his pressure and known to either personally chew someone out in a very nasty tirade or send a very nasty message to indicate his displeasure. So he is very hard. He expects results immediately. This raid's been planned for a while. They've had to put it off, not for clear weather in England, for clear weather and bombing weather in Germany. And so they have delayed this mission for about 2 weeks. It's supposed to go off sometime around the first week of August. They've had to keep delaying it, even before basically, you know, starting it off like they did today. Sorry, not today, but on August 17th. The morning of August 17th, the guy that's planning the raid, he's the head of 8th Bomber Command, it's Fred Anderson. This is his baby. He's under pressure from Arnold. He's under pressure from Aker to deliver. But they've delayed this thing so much that basically if it doesn't go off on August 17th, there is no raid. That's the first thing to kind of keep in mind is there's a lot of pressure on Fred Anderson to make this raid happen on August 17th. This is the last chance they send it off. The next issue is the fuel. The travel to North Africa is you're going to be really pushing the fuel because they don't have the B-24s. They're using extended tanks on the B-17s to push the B-17s there, but also because of the long flight time, they have to have enough daylight to land in North Africa. So daylight's a problem, fuel's a problem. So any delays, you can't have these guys looking for an airfield in the middle of the dark. Can't do that. So That's the next major problem that kind of creates this kind of perfect storm that we have. So again, they got to have enough daylight to see the airfield to land. They don't have modern equipment like we do today. And then the third thing that happens is the fog. Fog rolls in and it delays and delays. And, you know, the way I write about it in my book is I feel for Anderson. He's sitting in there and he knows he is going to get in deep trouble if he cancels this raid. But at the same time, it's almost like he can't cancel the raid with the pressure that's on him to basically make this raid happen. At the same time, the weather's not good enough for takeoff. Some of the B-17s are capable, and this is something I'm still working on the technical details, but basically you can send part of the force early. And that force would be LeMay's force, which is several bomb groups, including the 100. But if you delay too long, they won't have daylight to land. So this is where the daylight and the fuel come into consideration. So Anderson knows he can only delay so long. Ultimately, what he decides to do is to violate kind of the spirit of the mission, which is, I still got to send this thing out, but I'm going to send it out not how he wrote it up, which is, I'll send out the first wave first, wait for the weather to clear for the much larger wave, which is 230 B-17s. LeMay strike force is, I don't have the numbers with me right now, I should, but it's not nearly as large. It's only about one third of the entire strike force. So LeMay's force basically is sent out ahead, as they said, 5 hours ahead. And then the other B-17 formations kind of come up into the air afterwards. The problem that this naturally creates is, one, you're going to be attacked. The Germans are going to be allowed to attack the Regensburg force and the Schweinfurt force piecemeal instead of together. The pump fake, as you know, Neil Harding, commander of the 100th Bomb Group, kind of points out, isn't going to work. The 1-2-3 jab, which it's not a 1-2-3 jab, it's more of a left jab and a right hook, that's not going to happen. And so what happens is the worst case scenario when Anderson tries to get this thing to go, which is the first wave is going to get hit hard, as expected. But reinforcements, because of that first wave getting hit, are going to be vectored into the Regensburg-Schweinfurt area from eastern Germany, from all parts of Germany. And as that first force is getting attacked, the German radar operators can see the other force forming up over England. And so they start bringing in more reinforcements, fuel, ammo. And so they're ready for that second force in greater numbers than they are for the first force. And so, again, this is a massive raid. And the main reason it goes wrong, in my opinion, is I feel like Anderson was never given the full permission to scrap the mission. Yes, technically he was, but with the pressure he was under, I don't feel like he felt he could scrap the mission, and it should have been scrapped. And that's basically kind of what went wrong. And again, it's kind of a combination of multiple bad things happening at the same time to create this separation. I hope I explained that very well.
No, that was absolutely terrific. Sarah?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Luke, you did great. The only thing I was thinking too of what Crosby says in his memoir was talking about, like, we're talking about like the limited range with gas, but also what I had said before about how like pursuit aircraft and like their capacities for long range. Like, I don't remember, Luke, if you sent me a map or if it's something I was looking at, but like the P-51 Mustangs could go like 200 miles, I think. And then they eventually like are able to go longer, whatever I was looking at. It's just interesting to think about, like, when we're doing these deep raids into Germany, like how vulnerable the bombers are. And then also even when we are incorporating pursuit aircraft, how the pursuit can't go all the way, you know, like in 1943. And so just thinking about like the range you have.
I have a question about, like, we'll get to the disaster of the bombing and all these guys that get lost here in a second. There are two main questions I also had regarding the raid itself. They both revolve around Africa. By 1943, Africa, the Allies have complete control of Northern Africa. Is that correct? And then two, they're really able to fly after these bombs drop over Germany. able to fly over the rest of Europe and over the Mediterranean? Are they able? Is it just because Germany doesn't have the defenses, or are they flying at such a high? Why are they no longer in danger after they drop the bombs? Is my question.
That is a problem with the episode, and I don't fault the writers or the creators, because basically this is a long running gun battle from the moment they cross over into Belgium. I think the first fighter sighted at 10:25, and the main force, LeMay's main force, gets hit somewhere around 10:52 with the main waves. There's a 30-minute pause sometime before they get to Regensburg. Then over Regensburg, they get hit again. The pursuit stops at the Alps because the fighters turn back to rearm for the Schweinfurt force. That's largely why they're let go after the Alps. After that, they're over the Mediterranean Sea. The German fighter units in the Mediterranean are much more attrited by the American and Allied air forces in the Mediterranean theater. By this point, I believe Sicily has been secured. We still haven't really gotten into Italy yet. But at this point, North Africa is secured. Sicily is secured. There is a safe route once you get over the Alps. Also, you got to remember Switzerland's neutral. So some of the guys actually bail out over Switzerland. And in fact, if you read some of the accounts, they're trying to angle their parachutes to get into Switzerland.
No kidding. Okay. Yeah. Well, I have questions on the bailing out here in a moment. I have a quick question before we get into the battle itself. Cloud cover. I had a question regarding this. Cloud cover seems to be both a plus and minus here. How do we feel about clouds? Because it seems like they're an impediment to lining, to joining up as far as like the danger of collision, in-air collision and so forth. But you need them to not be there if you want to bomb. Like, what's the deal? How do clouds play into these bombing campaigns?
I was going to say before, can I correct something I said earlier? I meant to say the P-47s instead of the P-51s, because I was looking at my notes wrong. Because I was thinking about how Schweinfurt's raid, like there's 291 bombers that are escorted by P-47s, but only for the 200 miles. So it's basically halfway, the halfway point, because they're going 400 miles into Germany. So I just wanted to correct that. As for clouds, so, I mean, there's lots of things you could say, so I'll let Luke pick up from where I leave off, but I was going to say that, like, there's been talk in the episodes, like, different. I watched it, you know, thinking about it from, like, the perspective of somebody who doesn't know anything about, like, aviation or World War II aviation, or thinking about how you can fly using instruments, right, which they reference sometimes, which I realize, like, for a lay person, that just means that if you can't see out the plane or can't trust what you're seeing because of clouds or storms or whatever, that you need as a pilot to be able to fly just according to the instrument panel in front of you. And there's, you know, a device that lets you practice that on the ground that looks like a little miniature airplane. So you should be able to do that, but it's still, when you have that many planes like flying in formation, this is where I'll let like Luke take over. You still run into the issues that we talked about of basically like friendly fire, right? Where you like have planes that could accidentally run into each other, et cetera. But Luke, you can go if you want to.
No, you pretty much summed up the best point about like forming up over clouds. And this is a topic we've already hit and we'll hit again, which is the biggest impediment in terms of flying is you have to kind of, you know, you're instrument only. And from what I understand, again, this is something I need to double check my notes on. So again, I don't want to say it's gospel, but if I recall correctly, LeMay's force was chosen because they were better at instrument flying than some of the other 8th Air Force groups. So his force was, and in fact, LeMay leads from the front. And LeMay led from the front, expecting that that's the most dangerous position. As we find out in this episode, this is the first time where that's not the case. Germans changed tactics during this mission, which wasn't also explained in this episode. There's a lot of context missing from this episode, which is a little bit frustrating. And again, I don't want to get into rivet counting, but I think there's just a few lines here or there that would have provided a bigger picture, would have helped with some of these questions that, like, you know, we've discussed earlier. But Yes, cloud cover is a problem with instrument. You have instrument flying, but again, you have so many airplanes in the air, and some people are better at flying it than others. And then cloud cover over the target. So they have to know the cloud cover over the target before they take off and forming up. That's the two biggest issues. And one of the problems is this doctrine was tested in the American Southwest, where there was no cloud cover. So when it actually starts to meet kind of the realities of Europe, and you have so much cloud cover in Europe, this becomes a problem. And also affects the bombing seasons. There's a bombing campaign season, quite literally, because of cloud cover.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Let's jump into the battle itself. I remember I wrote down here, I kept a notepad, I think as you guys do, as we were watching these shows, and I wrote down the following five words. So this will be awful. Luke, you said they even pulled punches on this this battle. Can you talk a little bit about how bloody and how awful this is for the men in the air?
This is one of the punches is a mental one that they pulled that I noticed. As Sarah mentioned, the P-47s have a limited range. I can tell you almost exactly the town where that fuel ran out because the Germans knew it. Eupen, Belgium. And one of the scariest things that these deep raids would have before the P-51 and the P-38 made its entrance into the 8th Air Force is that American bombers, a lot of times, would be able to see the German planes forming up way into the distance and preparing for their attack runs. They could see them climbing. They could see them getting set. In some cases, they could see them kind of getting all ready to pounce. And it's one of the most horrifying experiences to see. And just they're not even attacking you yet. And even German pilots admitted that that pre-attack, that pre-battle intensity, as they're climbing and they're watching the bomber stream and they're watching, there's this anxiety that builds. But in terms of also pulling punches is that Crosby said it was like, if I recall, there were parachutes littered from their formation, and not just the 100th, but all that first wave and the second wave, parachutes all, you could follow the entire track of the raid by the B-17s that were falling out of the sky, by the smoke, by the parachutes. Guys were jumping out and hitting other planes when they jumped out. You saw a little bit of that. That was happening all the time. One of the guys that got shot down, I checked the missing air crew report, I think on Biddick, and his plane when it went down, and the co-pilot was not killed. I'm trying to make sure I remember this correctly. The co-pilot was actually not killed in the head-on pass. He actually tried to bail out and didn't clear and got stuck on the plane. His parachute got stuck on the plane or something like that. I can't remember which aircraft it was, but one of the 100th Bomb Group's co-pilots got stuck on the airplane with his parachute and he couldn't get loose. And then his chute wouldn't open when he got free. So there's a lot of bodies flying around in the air. Crosby notes it. The missing air crew reports note it. And it's the reason why it's hard to keep track of which incident happened to which plane is reading through all these missing air crew reports. They read very similar and seeing bodies flying around through the air. And it's not just one here. It's a lot of bodies flying, guys bailing out, guys getting killed. Usually these guys fire in burst fire to not, overheat their barrels and to save their ammo. This is one of the few raids where they're just hammering away and there's hardly a pause between bursts. And so when I say they toned it down a lot. And also, I mentioned this to my wife. I said, this is only a 48-minute episode. This mission went on for hours. This air battle went on for hours, nonstop. And so, when I said they toned it down, they really did. And I don't think – I think that was the right decision. But, it's just hard to really capture – the point I'm trying to make is it's hard to really capture how chaotic – how long and how bloody this battle was.
Sarah, what were your thoughts on this battle?
I liked what Luke said earlier about choices, because what I was thinking about a lot was just thinking about the scene that Luke just set for us, how many individual decisions are made by not just the pilots in trying to decide do we bail? Do we keep going? Like, what are, do we try to land? Like, what are we going to try to do here? Depending on the nature of the men and their injuries who are in the plane, right? Or trying to decide, like in the one instance you saw with the ball turret gunner, right? Do I leave someone who's stuck in here to bail and potentially save myself? Because once you reach a certain altitude, it's too late. You can't parachute out. You're going to die, right? So you have to make that decision. And you're making, everyone is making all these little tiny decisions in the midst of war. So in the chaos of everything that's happening around them with the trauma that they're all experiencing. And they're just all trying to like quickly make decisions. And so I was thinking about that. And I was also thinking about how, like, you, when you think about World War II and we think about how there's like the POW MIA, like accounting agency, or groups like Colin Colburn's Project Recovery, like a civilian organization that try to find missing POW, or not just POWs, sorry, but missing personnel from US wars. This is how you have so many people still missing, right? This is how you have, like, there was a WASP who lost her husband, and she finds out later that he had like bailed out of his aircraft in like France, but he didn't survive, and nobody knew about it until she's like in her 70s or 80s. And the only way she knew about it was to visit this place in France, right? So it just shows you how you can't keep neat records on people, right, who are like fighting in these sorts types of situations. And also, I don't remember which character said it at the beginning of the episode, but I loved the line, whoever said, lives ain't worth a nickel. I don't know if you, either one of you remember this. It was just thrown out at the very beginning.
No.
And when he, right, whenever he said lives ain't worth a nickel, I was like, that's the perfect way to describe this situation, because these men are viewed as weapons of war. They are, you know, being used for this larger purpose, but also, like Luke was saying, you are at the mercy of the people who you're under command of, right? So when they're making decisions on your behalf, you just, yeah, are at that mercy. So even if bad decisions are made, mistakes are made, or that can be like at the level of like the pilot, if you're in the air crew, but even your commanding officers, whoever's making a decision about strategy, all these little details are affecting your life. And while your lives do matter to your family and friends back home, and we would argue, you know, that America as a whole respects people who served during World War II, in the midst of actual war, your life really isn't worth very much, because there's a larger like purpose or mission. And oftentimes that comes, you have to basically just decide what cost, at what cost, right? So even if you know that this mission might be a potential disaster, will it destroy the ball bearing factories enough that it'll, you know, be worth the cost of all these lives? And so I really liked those like moments where they're, the men are waiting around and like waiting and waiting for this mission, you know, and then like throw out this line that they feel like their lives aren't worth anything.
And again, that's why I think it would have been nice to have like a couple big picture scenes with like 8th Air Force headquarters stressing and sweating bullets, because the commander of the 8th Air Force got criticized from time to time of caring too much for his men by Hap Arnold. And so did Anderson, and they did not, they were sweating this one out. And that, and again, that's one of the reasons why I am a little bit more forgiving to them. Yeah, they're not flying the mission, but they care very much about these lives that they're having to sacrifice. And they know what's about to happen. And so it's one of the no movie or episode could capture how horrific this raid is from everybody that participated it, from the ground level to those who flew the mission, mentally, physically. And just as Sarah said, you know, lives are just being thrown around, and it's hard on everybody involved.
Yeah, it's really embodied. We should go ahead and go talk about it, right? Embodied by the death of Kurt, who is really kind of the third lead in this series. I think we all love the actor. Of the three guys, he seemed to have maybe the sweetest presence. I don't know if this is the right way to say this, but he was, you know, he felt, boy, you know, a competent pilot we'd seen him land a really damaged plane in Scotland in the first two episodes. And then he just, boy, that when he's going down, you're hoping for a moment that he's going to be able to pull it off. He's like, I've got this spot, we can do it. And then, oh my God. And the thing that comes to mind here is, you know, when Buck or Bucky make it to Africa, the first thing they do is look around and say, hey, did my other guys make it here? And the psychological toll of, I don't know as a human being how you can mentally compartmentalize. And I guess that you have to in order to survive these wars. And maybe that's one of the traumas of war, is compartmentalize losing your friends like these guys are forced to do just to get through the war. What were your thoughts on Kurt's death? Did it hit you like when you were watching this part in the episode?
So Crosby actually says of Biddick that he was a, quote, sweet guy. So even using the word sweet, that's how he would describe him. And he said that he was, quote, one of the most popular pilots in the original group. So just obviously he's writing this, you know, after the war and, you know, with these memories. But I think that they did a good job capturing that, where you do feel an emotional hit when he dies. Not that you wouldn't anyway, but you know, sometimes you see death in a war movie and there's like so much happening that it just feels relentless and you don't really feel an emotional tie anymore. I thought they did a good job giving you that like emotional pull with him, even though there've only been three episodes of this series and they're, you know, showing you little snapshots. I thought they did good with that.
Yeah.
But Luke, you can disagree if you want to.
No, I actually completely agree. And again, just to kind of, Crosby has a really great sense of, Biddick's loss seemed to really bother Crosby because, one, he's a good personality within the group. He's one of those guys that everybody likes. This is the first real big loss in kind of personalities that they liked in the group. Not to say that any of the losses were non-impactful, but Biddick was a very popular guy in the group. There are certain people in groups, you know, and in organizations that their loss impacts the organization emotionally differently than others. And Biddick was one of those guys. But also, to add on to that, is that one of the reasons why Biddick's loss stung so hard, according to Crosby, he says, all that extra navigation, all that extra work we did at Trondheim Raid, it was nothing. It was worthless. Everything I did, all that we did to pull him in and get him in, it was worthless. We just lost him.
Yeah.
You know, and that was how it reads. And you could see the frustration, the anger, and the despair in Crosby's writings on it. And the entire Trondheim raid to Crosby felt like the entire aftermath of all that navigation felt worthless. Because what they did to save him didn't save him for this raid.
Do we get a sense, guys, of what the Germans are going through? Obviously, this show is thus far been depicting the American experience. Do we get a sense when we see these German pilots, the Luftwaffe, going up against these bombers, and they're also, as we see, taking losses? I know one of the narratives of the war is as the war goes on, the Luftwaffe takes such heavy losses that they're eventually getting decimated. But like, do we know where the Luftwaffe is, say, in 43, as we head into 44?
Well, I would say by August, we can safely say most of those German fighter units have transferred now from the Eastern Front to the defense of the German homeland. Mueller and Caldwell wrote a really good book about the air defense of Germany, which basically details some of this. But the problem we get into here, and Sarah might know where I'm going with this, is with fighter claims. The 8th Air Force combined fighter claims for the raid was 288 German fighters shot down. It was no secret that this was all BS. Guys claimed a lot of planes they did not shoot down, and there's a lot of planes they damaged that made it safely back. In actuality, the bombers out of both forces shot down 21 German fighters. And another 21 were shot down by escorts going in and out, which shows the importance of the escort fighter in this whole story. This is one of the reasons why Hap Arnold and a lot of other American senior commanders say, oh, we can't send these guys up without long-range escort fighters anymore. Because the difference between having escort fighters and not having escort fighters is a big deal. at least in shooting German fighters down. I will say they're taking losses. They're feeling the sting. They're feeling the punch because they're also having to fight night missions as well. But they're really not feeling the full weight of the Americans and the British yet. It's because they haven't figured out that ability. And this is something not to plug my book too much, but this is something I write about in my book, is that they're not really coordinating their operations effectively to maximize the pressure on the Luftwaffe. So they can kind of rest pilots. They can rotate pilots a little bit better because you're not getting hit constantly from multiple directions. And that's something we see differently in 44. So in 43, they are taking losses. These are pretty ugly hair battles, but they're not feeling the same kind of pressure and strain. And again, they're facing a really good German fighter force as well. A lot of these guys have a lot of experience, more than the Americans.
I'm wondering the other aspect of this, and you guys have both, Sarah and Luke, you both touched on this, is the crews, the pilots and crews abandoning ship, if you will, abandoning their forts and parachuting out. This boy, I didn't know it was so commonplace. I don't know, that may sound naive, but it just seemed like, okay, we're out of here, you know. And so we have a lot of guys who are, and I guess they're going to get, from the previews, we're going to get into this more into the following episodes. What's happening to these young men as they are deploying their parachutes over different parts of Belgium, occupied Germany, places like that? Is that a thing we're going to dive into more as this series goes on, or what happens to these guys? Are there, most of them getting captured? Are they finding their way back home? What's happening here?
I was wondering if they're going to explore that more, just because now I can't remember the name of the character who was talking to the Belgians and was like, they were asking him to make that decision. Wait, was that the preview for the next? I'm sorry if that was a preview and not the
No. That's part of this episode. But it was, in my mind, maybe the most terrifying part of this episode was when he's like, you're not gonna look at me, you're not gonna remember my name, you have to make a choice. And I'm like, are they gonna shoot him if he says he wants to be captured? Or if he says I want to escape? Like, what's gonna I was worried.
It's literally, there's so much you could say, but it's based on the whims of where you land with your parachute, right? Like Luke was saying, you hope for the best. But the people who, so when he said in that moment, yeah, when the Belgian was saying in that moment, that man, and he was like, you have two choices here, right? When he mentioned the Germans, he said, if you're taken as a prisoner of war, the Germans will follow the Geneva Convention, like, you know, just so you know. But then also you have the chance to like try to leave, like, you know, so you have this moral dilemma, right, of what you want to do or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can't know. Like in that moment, there's no way that an individual could know if he can trust the people who are offering to help you escape or not, right? So that's an element of this. And then there's also the element of, you think of like France, right? Where there's a chunk of France that, like, a French people that want to help you like get out, and then others who are allied with the Germans. So it depends on people's like where they lie politically, but then also it depends on, you know, even for people who are captured and are prisoners of war with the prisoner of war experience in the Germans, which we can talk more about later if we want to, but there was like a book, it's a memoir. It's called Red Tail Captured. Alexander Jefferson is like a B-17 pilot. He's a black, sorry, not B-17. Oh my word. Now I can't remember what he flies. P-47? I'll have to come back to you.
P-51.
P-51, you're right. So he, Alexander Jefferson, was captured, and he talks about how the Germans like treated him really well and he had a good POW experience. But then you hear about other people that don't have. So even within like the POW world, you can have different experiences. So it's very, very, it's varied.
Yeah, it depends on. This is kind of difficult for me because I don't want to reveal spoilers, but we will get a lot more of the POW experience in this show. I will say that much. It, as Sarah pointed out, there's a lot of luck involved depending on where you bail out. There's also luck involved in not just the location, but which side, how the people feel about you, when you, basically land. So if you're in the occupied countries, It depends on their attitude towards the Germans. Also, it depends on if the Germans have spotted your chute and are on the way, because sometimes the resistance or people that would be more inclined to help you realize the Germans are about to be there in about 5 minutes, and they're just going to go, we're handing you over to the Germans, they're already here. You know, I actually knew a B-24 co-pilot that had happened. He was he landed, and an Albanian woman captured him. And basically, she said, the Germans already saw you. They're going to get you anyways. So I'll take the silk from your chute because I want that. And then I'll hand you over to the Germans when they get here because the silk's so valuable. We see that a lot, you know, in the occupied. But in Germany, it's even worse because that luck factor, it depends on how recent a raid against Germany's been and the nature of that raid. Because after some of the firebombing raids against Germany, some Americans are executed by the local townspeople who capture them. It's not uncommon. So again, there's a lot of, depends on where you land, depends on who you meet. And again, there are also some Germans that if they capture you, they'll hand you over to the Luftwaffe. And it also depends on what camp you go to. Do you go to a camp run by the SS? Do you go to a camp run by the Luftwaffe? Which camp do you end up at? And how's it run? And where's it located? And so there's a lot of factors basically that are in play here.
All right. I have one final thought regarding this particular episode, which is when our few planes make it back to Africa, they are in absolute tatters. It's completely shot to hell. I am shocked by this. And I wonder what happens to these planes. Are they able to patch them back up? Do they replace them with new planes? What happens to the planes? These planes are shot to hell and back with hardly with a wing left on them. What happens to the planes themselves? Are they able to take these things and get them back at airport again?
That's the ideal.
Yeah.
Right? Is to be able to use resources.
Yeah. Man, I had that stat, but I left it in a different room. I written it out on a notepad. But there's a lot of damaged planes from this raid, obviously. But a good chunk of LeMay's force that flew to Africa, those planes are scrap metal. They are not going to be able to fly. And so the other pilots are going to have to find different ways to get back. And there's different ways you can fly them back and get them back to England because, you know, the Allies do control most of the Med at this point. You just can't go directly back over France. Now, those that are able to be patched up and fly again, they get a few days of rest while the ground crews repair their planes, and then they got to fly another mission. They load them up with bombs. They fly a mission into occupied France. They hit their target and they fly back to Thorpe Abbotts where they land. And so there are some that have to go fly another mission a few days after this. Others have to basically either by plane, I think it's by plane, fly around basically Spain and basically make the trek back to the United Kingdom that way. But there were a number of planes that were scrap metal. And according to LeMay's report, all four crews that ditched in the Med were recovered. And so they are also sent back to the UK as well.
Well, I'm feeling all of a sudden much, much better about my flight to West Palm Beach on Wednesday after seeing what these planes can go through. Because I think if these guys can handle Nazi-occupied France and whatnot, I can probably fly over Arkansas. All right, guys, final thoughts as we're heading into episode 4 next week. What are we looking forward to? Luke?
I'll go. Again, I was just trying to see if Sarah wanted to go. I feel like I've been a bit too talkative this episode. But it's going to get darker. It's going to get worse for the 100th Bomb Group and for the 8th Air Force. I don't know if they're going to show how much of a pause there was. I think there'll be a bit of a time jump because I don't think they're going to talk about a lot of the operations in September because they're mostly very limited and over protected territory where the fighters can escort them. And the Germans are also kind of recovering after these raids as well. So I think we're going to jump right into October. And the culmination of the 1943 air offensive is in October. It's known as Black Week. The 100th Bomb Group will not even really make it to, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but they're not going to really be able to participate fully in the Black Thursday mission call in the second Schweinfurt raid because of because of the mauling they're going to take in the missions leading up to Schweinfurt. So again, that's all I'll say about that, but it's going to get darker. It's going to get worse. And I think the next episode will get us there. It'll either be episode 4 or episode 5, where we will see the probably the worst week of the 8th Air Force, which is Black Week, which is in the middle of October of 43. And multiple bomb groups are just mauled during that week.
The only expression I thought of.
Now that Luke's given us that to look forward to.
Yeah. Right. The only thing that I didn't expound on it first, because the only thing I could think of was just that I'm bracing myself for the carnage. So I wasn't sure. I don't really have anything else to add to that. So I am bracing myself.
So it's only going to get worse. Okay. All right. So 3 episodes in, we've met our guys, some of the women as well. I think looks like we've got more romances on the way as well for these young lads of the Air Force. We'll see what happens next. Sarah Myers, Luke Truxell, thank you both for being here, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right.